Today is Friday, July 17th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as coronavirus cases in the U.S. skyrocket, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the president needs to admit he has made bad decisions.
Mr. President, admit it. You've gone down the wrong path. Ask for direction. Ask for direction from our scientists who know better. They knew better.
Western nations accuse Russian hackers of trying to steal vaccine research. And a young climate activist is demanding nations take action for future generations. It's all on today's International Edition. Rising coronavirus infections across dozens of U.S. states are threatening the economy, forcing businesses and consumers to freeze spending and keeping the unemployment rate stubbornly high. Florida hit another ominous mark as the coronavirus continues surging across the nation. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Florida's reporting 156 deaths today, two dozen more than the record set just 2 days ago. The Miami-Dade area is the epicenter, and Miami Mayor Francis Suarez says officials are considering another blanket lockdown.
I think we've got to continue to communicate how serious this is.
Half the states are now requiring masks, with Colorado and Arkansas among the latest. But there will not be a national mandate.
We leave it to localities to make the decisions with regard to face coverings, and the CDC guidelines remain the same today, recommended but not required.
White House spokeswoman Kayleigh McEnany, Target, CVS, and Publix are joining other major national retailers in requiring customers wear masks. Sagar Magani, Washington.
At a news conference Thursday, Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called on President Trump to start listening to the medical experts and acknowledge his approach to the pandemic has been wrong.
I have concluded that he is like the man who refuses to ask for directions. All of the answers are there. The scientists have the answers.
Meanwhile, the World Health Organization warns that the coronavirus pandemic raging across the globe will get worse if countries do not stick to strict healthcare precautions. But the world body also says this needs to be done without shifting from lockdown to lockdown. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo reports.
As coronavirus infections surpass 13 million globally with more than a half a million deaths, the World Health Organization is sounding a new alarm.
Let me be blunt. Too many countries are headed in the wrong direction.
The head of the world body insists without mandating basic outbreak control methods such as physical distancing, wearing masks, or staying home when sick, there's only one way for this pandemic to go.
It's going to get worse and worse.
His remarks come as WHO reported yet another worldwide record of more than 230,000 new cases in 24 hours on Sunday. 10 countries accounted for 80% of that total. More than half of the new confirmed cases came from the United States and Brazil.
Countries are losing gains made as proven measures to reduce risk are not implemented or followed. We're seeing this across the Americas, South Asia, and several countries in Africa.
South Africa accounts for most of the confirmed cases in Africa, with nearly 300,000 cases, including more than 4,000 deaths, according to the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Amid a surge in hospitalizations, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa addressed the nation Sunday.
We are now recording well over 12,000 new cases every day. That is the equivalent of 500 new infections every hour of the day.
He reinstated a series of measures, including banning liquor sales to minimize hospitalization due to alcohol-related injuries and ordering a nighttime curfew. The South African president also made it mandatory for all residents to wear face masks when in public. In the U.S., several states are rolling back reopening plans. In California, Governor Gavin Newsom ordered bars and indoor restaurant dining to shut down statewide and also ordered churches, gyms, and hair salons to close in the hardest hit counties.
We're continuing to see hospitalizations rise in the state. We're continuing to see a modest increase in ICUs and number of beds represented by ICU patients throughout the state of California. And we continue to experience an increase in the rate of positivity here in the state of California.
A nail salon owner says the new order will not only affect him, but so many others.
If we don't make no money to pay the rent, the landlord suffer too. So everybody has a problem. Yeah, and then also we don't have income, and then the family, our family, the problem too.
Something the WHO head touched on this week.
We need to reach a sustainable situation where we have adequate control of this virus without shutting down our lives entirely or lurching from lockdown to lockdown, which has a hugely detrimental impact on societies.
And the measures put in place in country by country so far have had varying degrees of success or failure. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
African states are coming together to develop a continental strategy to fight the spread of coronavirus. As VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg, the continent's top epidemiologist will talk about what steps states are taking as the virus takes hold, especially in South Africa.
Africa was never going to escape the spread of the coronavirus, the continent's top epidemiologist says. He adds that African scientists and doctors are applying lessons they learned from the continent's battle with the HIV pandemic and stepping up their role in the fight. Dr. John Nkengasong, director of the African Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, says labs, epidemiologists, and doctors are hard at work across the continent, which has now recorded more than 640,000 cases of COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus. More than 6.5 million tests have been conducted, most of them in hotspot countries like South Africa, Egypt, Nigeria, Ghana, and Algeria. He said 64 clinical drug trials are currently happening, and South Africa is leading the continent's first vaccine trial. Eventually, he said, if a successful vaccine is found, African countries should be allowed to produce and distribute it themselves.
It is a strong belief that Africa should play an active role in the process of development of the vaccines and uptake of the vaccines and not wait until vaccines are developed before distributed in Africa. So we are positioning the continent to play a coordinated role to enhance and accelerate the clinical trials of any promising vaccine candidates on the continent.
Additionally, he said scientists are convening with traditional medicine practitioners to discuss how they can contribute. And the African CDC is supporting laboratories in Ethiopia, Senegal, and Nigeria that are working to sequence the virus's genome. But he said the fight cannot be won by scientists alone. He laid out the continent's plan of action.
We need to ramp up testing. We need to trace those who are infected and isolate them and make provisions for appropriate treatment. The second thing we must do is to engage communities very actively. The battle against COVID-19 is that will be decided at a community level. And without proper community engagement, community ownership and response, we will not be able to conduct the appropriate contact tracing and care. And lastly, we are calling on all countries in Africa, member states, to ensure that we have a policy of universal masking. That is, we should all wear masks when we are in open, in public places there.
While he and South African officials also noted that COVID-19 testing is improving, both in terms of the number of tests and in terms of the speed of results, the number of confirmed cases is keeping pace. As of this week, he said, the continent is seeing an average of 17,000 new cases per day. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Western governments accused hackers believed to be part of Russian intelligence of trying to steal valuable private information about a coronavirus vaccine on Thursday, calling out the Kremlin in an unusually detailed public warning to scientists and medical companies. AP correspondent Zuria Shackley reports.
The three nations allege that hacking group APT-29, also known as Cozy Bear and said to be part of the Russian intelligence service, is attacking academic and pharmaceutical research institutions involved in coronavirus vaccine development. Britain's National Cybersecurity Center made the announcement, which was coordinated with authorities in the US and Canada. The persistent and ongoing attacks are seen by intelligence officials as an effort to steal intellectual property rather than to disrupt research. Zara Shackley, London.
The coronavirus pandemic is changing the way American politics is being practiced. One example, the political convention and all the traditions around it ahead of the upcoming presidential election. VOA's Steve Reddish explains.
For Democrats, the reality of the coronavirus pandemic forced a change of plans. Instead of staging an arena-packed event to crown Joe Biden as their presidential nominee, they will hold a virtual convention. Elaine Kmark is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
We don't know that much about this virus, but what we have learned is that it transmits in closed indoor spaces in close proximity to people. So that says, oh, maybe you shouldn't have a convention, a traditional convention.
Thousands of delegates are being told not to travel to the convention city, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Democratic Party leaders will be there to conduct necessary business in a giant virtual meeting. Again, Elaine Kmark.
Other than the backdrop of 20,000 people packed into an arena, it will still be television.
Democrats reportedly plan a mix of live programming from Milwaukee with curated content to fill 4 days of primetime television programming, leading up to Biden's acceptance speech as the party's presidential nominee. Laura Brown is the director of George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management.
I think that the Democrats' sort of certainty around planning this is going to serve them better. And what I mean by that is that the Democrats have time to plan. They have time to consider innovative technologies. They have the freedom and the latitude to put kind of effort and energy into how do we create the best sort of virtual event we can create.
In early April, Democrats postponed their convention, originally scheduled for mid-July, to begin on August 17th, just 1 week before the Republican convention, to renominate President Donald Trump, who insists on a traditional celebration. Jay Kost is a political historian at the American Enterprise Institute.
I think the most important thing for the parties at the conventions is to get their nominee in front of an arena-sized crowd that is cheering and screaming and applauding. And there has always been, as in the television era, there's always been pressure to do that.
Once the governor of the state of North Carolina required convention attendees to wear face masks, Republicans decided to do the party's business in the host city of Charlotte and instead chose Jacksonville, Florida, to host an event celebrating President Trump's renomination and acceptance speech. Again, George Washington University's Laura Brown.
The Republicans are divided in both their intentionality in terms of the business meetings for the delegates and the rallies for the people. But there is a problem in that they're not only having to kind of negotiate two separate locations and dividing up events, but they are also putting themselves kind of at risk of having to adapt on the fly. And adapting on the fly when it comes to technology is almost always bad.
At the end of June, the city of Jacksonville began requiring face masks at indoor events. Steve Reddish, VOA News, Washington.
Nearly 5 months ago, the U.S. and Afghan Taliban entered into a peace agreement. As part of that deal, the U.S. said that by this week, it would reduce its troop numbers in Afghanistan down to 8,600 and withdraw from five bases. The Pentagon said this week that it has lived up to its commitments, but U.S. Marine General Kenneth Frank McKenzie, the head of U.S. Central Command, told VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb in an exclusive interview earlier in the week via phone from the region that the Taliban has not lived up to its commitments.
Has the Taliban kept up their commitments, in your opinion?
So I would not say that they have yet. We expected to see a reduction in violence. And while the Taliban have been scrupulous about not attacking U.S. or coalition forces, in fact, the violence against the Afghans is higher than it's been in quite a while. It's one of the highest, most violent periods of the war that we've seen to date. average lethality is down just a little bit, but the number of enemy-initiated attacks is in fact very worrisome. We need to get to intra-Afghan dialogue. It is uncertain that we're going to get to that at any time soon. That's really the next critical thing that needs to happen. And that's what leads us to the long-term conditions that would allow us to actually see a future where there's far less U.S. or coalition presence in the country.
How confident, General McKenzie, are you this far into the deal that a peaceful resolution can stem from this? Or are we on the verge of a reset?
Now, I wouldn't say that I'm confident or not confident. We don't need to believe in the Taliban. We don't need to like or dislike the Taliban. We need to study and observe the Taliban and see if they keep their commitments and move forward. And I think, honestly, the government of Afghanistan is trying very hard to do, you know, what they've undertaken to do as part of the agreement. I think right now the Taliban is not in the same place. And so that's how I draw my assessment of what the future is.
What's the repercussion to the Taliban if they're not being helpful? What does the U.S. military plan to do if they're not helpful and they're not keeping up to their commitments?
Carla, that ultimately is going to be a political, not a military decision. But if the Taliban envision a future where there's very little or no foreign presence in Afghanistan, then they have to create the conditions for that. And the conditions for that would be an agreement with the existing government of Afghanistan, a way forward that has a significant reduction in violence, and absolute promises that are verifiable to ensure that Al-Qaeda and ISIS have no safe haven in Afghanistan.
You had asked your team to further dig into the matter of Russian bounties being offered to the Taliban in exchange for the deaths of U.S. service members. Have your people found any more evidence to back up that initial report?
So, Carla, I asked that question back in January, you know, when I first received the report. And so we are continuing to dig. I have found nothing yet that would make me change my judgment that it is very worrisome, it's very concerning, but it's not proven to my satisfaction that actually occurred. We've really looked hard. We continue to look. As we continue to look at a broad variety of things. But I've got nothing back yet that would change my judgment on it.
You know, General, I was in Afghanistan with General Nicholson back in 2017 when he was telling reporters that the U.S. had continued to get reports of the Russians arming the Taliban. What makes the idea of offering bounties so different than arming the Taliban to fight against the U.S. forces?
I think it's the human connection that you tie it to wanting to kill a specific kind of person, a specific American or a specific Afghan. I think that's what it makes it, frankly, you know, morally abhorrent and against, you know, and really against the Western way of war. We would not, so I find it particularly distasteful to even consider that. Look, we know Russia does not mean us well. We know that. They are not our friends. I've said this before. They have no interest in our success in Afghanistan or in a lot of other places as well. So it should not surprise us, and it does not surprise me that they work against us. That's just a given.
U.S. Marine General Kenneth Frank McKenzie, the head of U.S. Central Command, speaking to VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Meanwhile, a day after that conversation, a Taliban spokesman disputed the general's assertions, telling VOA his group has been cooperative in efforts to set the stage as quickly as possible for launching peace talks. Social media in Egypt is exploding with voices echoing the Me Too movement following the July 4th arrest of Ahmed Bassam Zaki, a former college student accused of raping or harassing as many as 100 women and girls. His arrest came after a barrage of Instagram posts making the accusations against him. VOA's Heather Murdoch has this report from Istanbul with Hamada El Rassam in Cairo.
It started with an Instagram account, Assault Police, which picked up almost 165,000 followers in less than 2 weeks. On it, about 100 women and girls claimed to have been harassed, sexually assaulted, or raped by Ahmed Bassam Zaki, a college student, formerly of the prestigious American University in Cairo. Egypt has long struggled with sexual harassment, with one United Nations study showing that nearly all Egyptian women say at some point they have been victims. But 25-year-old Maya Mahmoud says most women don't report assaults or harassment, fearing retaliation or stigma. But this case is different. After the women and girls spoke up, Zaki was arrested, and prosecutors say he will be held for investigation into six separate incidents until late next week. Zaki's family has said very little, but his father did tell one reporter that he thinks the charges are false and that this is an internet pylon. But more accounts keep popping up, with users posting accusations against other alleged sexual abusers in what some commentators are calling Egypt's Me Too movement. Heba Adel of the Egyptian Female Lawyers Initiative says it's too soon to say how this case will turn out, but it's proving the power of social media in influencing the government. Besides quickly arresting the accused, Egyptian lawmakers have adopted a bill that says victims' names must be withheld from public documents to protect them from threats after they make an accusation. Lawyers say this will encourage more victims to report, but there is still a lot more to do. This is lawyer Karim Azat. He says Egypt needs a separate department to take care of cases that involve violence against women, including rape, harassment, and domestic violence. Prosecutors say Zaki has confessed to blackmailing women and girls, but denies all other charges. Heather Murdoch, VOA News in Istanbul, with Hamada El-Rassam in Cairo.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Hackers broke into the Twitter accounts of world leaders, celebrity, and tech moguls in one of the most high-profile security breaches in recent years. The hacking on Wednesday highlighted a major flaw with the service millions of people have come to rely on as an essential communications tool. It raised questions about Twitter's ability to secure its service against election interference and misinformation ahead of the U.S. presidential election in November. Swedish activist Greta Thunberg is urging European leaders to take emergency action on climate change, saying people in power have practically given up on the possibility of handing over a decent future to coming generations. The 17-year-old told Reuters mounting a serious response will require governments to transform the entire economic system. VOA's International Edition continues. NASA plans to launch its newest Mars rover by the end of the month after a hardware issue scrapped an earlier launch. The space agency has until the middle of August to complete a successful launch before planetary alignment issues force a costly delay to the mission. VOA's Arash Arabasadi brings us The Week in Space.
Recently at Florida's Cape Canaveral, scientists and the mission crew tucked NASA's Perseverance rover inside the nose of the Mars 2020 spacecraft for a rescheduled launch. Project scientist Kenneth Farley.
There have been a number of technical issues getting the rocket together. Spacecraft is all ready to go, and as recently as a couple of days ago, the spacecraft was bolted on top of the rocket.
Scientists are now conducting final tests on the craft and its booster.
One of the hard things about launching rockets is you have to get everything packaged just right into the spacecraft. So the delay is not because of anything with the rover, but it's just a matter of packaging the rover within that rocket and making sure then that rocket is ready for launch.
NASA's Bethany Ellman says the agency remains upbeat about the mission's two-week window after issues with the rocket scrapped the original launch.
Typically what happens is a launch goes the first day if all conditions on the vehicle are green and the weather is good. The window is to allow for bad weather, for other things to happen, for contingency. So we're pretty optimistic that we're going to get off the ground.
But if it's not launched by mid-August, the mission will have to wait until Earth and Mars return to proper alignment in 2022. The delay alone could cost about $500 million. The U.S., China, and UAE are sending unmanned spacecraft to Mars beginning this week, continuing the search for signs of ancient life on the planet. In another development following recent appearances above Italy, France, and the United States, the comet C2020F3, known as NEOWISE, blazed a path over Northern Ireland. NASA calls it a natural firework, and NEOWISE should be visible after sunset until mid-August. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
New York Philharmonic's first and only African-American principal player is taking a stand of his own for the Black Lives Matter movement. In a black and white video posted on social media platforms, clarinetist Anthony McGill called on musicians to take two knees for black lives. Elena Wolf has the story narrated by Anna Rise.
Yeah, maybe I'll play a little bit.
Like many professional musicians, New York Philharmonic clarinetist Anthony McGill appreciates silence. The first and only African-American in New York's Philharmonic, he was bothered by the sounds of protests outside his windows, but not because they broke the silence outside.
I'm still, like I said, I'm still locked down, like, as much as I know. I've been kind of watching it and paying attention to it. But I haven't protested since I was a young child. I thought, you know, everyone is at home. And I think we all saw what happened. A lot of us agree that a lot of this is wrong. And so why can't we say something about that? I think it's okay to.
The black and white video statement appeared on social media networks in June under the hashtag Take Two Knees. There were no words, just music.
So that's where this came from, and I challenged anybody to also take two knees for justice, for righteousness, for beauty, for love, for connection, for humanity, all of these things that I think a lot of us believe in, and to do it in their way.
He says taking a knee can be a powerful gesture, but taking two is different.
And also, what I realized only after watching my video is that there are lots of different interpretations of what it could mean. The image of someone taking two knees, it could be an image of people kneeling down to pray. I mean, there's so many different interpretations, and I didn't think very specifically about any of them. At first, I wasn't going to use the clarinet at all. I was just going to taped myself just falling down to two knees, you know, kind of helplessly.
McGill didn't think twice about what to play in his now viral video, America the Beautiful.
This is the kind of thing that we need to match our actions with our words, with the words of a song as beautiful as this, that we all know from the time we're kids. So that's why I played that. And I did my own little twist on it. And at a certain point, I made the tone a little bit minor, a little bit sad, a little bit haunting, just to say we have a lot of work to do still to live up to the ideals of our country and our nation.
Every day since McGill published the video, more and more new ones appear on YouTube under the hashtag he created. They are all filled with different types of music, but every single one is a stark contrast in black and white. For Elena Wolf in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And Ludacris, who's been known for making music that usually needs to include a parental advisory, is venturing into child-friendly music with Kid Nation. The rapper says the whole platform is by kids and for kids to give them a voice. He says it's creating songs to teach children about current events such as Get Along, released during the protests following the killing of George Floyd by a Minnesota police officer, as well as Stay Clean as the world battles the COVID-19 pandemic. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful weekend.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Whoa. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews. Ooh. Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Ah. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday.